Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist. Tonight, I have a special interview with Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph Farrell on secret UFO physics and the mysterious death of MIT plasma scientist Nuno Lorero. Please join us.
Joseph, it's great to have you back with us.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, indeed. And the year started off with a bang, of course. thank God the bang
war,
wasn't in Greenland.
Go to war with Denmark any day.
We've been wanting Denmark for a long time. They just put 20 troops in there. That's outrageous.
20. It's probably overkill.
J.D. Vance is going over there with a shield and some arrows. He's going to get it himself. With Marco Rubio in the background with a whip.
They're all wearing blonde wigs and horned helmets.
This is like past life memory taken too far.
Siegfried.
Turn up that Wagner.
Turn up that Wagner.
Get off my Greenland. Anyway, I'll start with Greenland.
Okay.
For two reasons.
Okay.
One, this episode gets us into very deep information about technologies that are hidden, exotic technologies, and technologies that scientists have paid their lives for. Mm-hmm. So something very strange and mysterious. Way back there in my mind is a story by John Keel about the government in 68 finding a transmitter in Greenland that they didn't know the nature of it, and they didn't know how old it was. They could not figure out anything about it. Mm-hmm. That's some 50 some odd years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was just hanging out back there. Then there's a Casey reading where he talks about strifes in the Davis Strait regarding Greenland. And he includes Greenland as part of the Earth Changes piece where waterways will appear. Mm-hmm. Those two things just hanging out there on the kind of esoteric tip. And then all of this language coming in very strong from Trump about Greenland. It's not like Greenland has never been raised as an acquisition before. It has. But Joseph, what are they doing with this insane emphasis in war language, Department of War language around Greenland?
That's a good question, and let's put a little more sauce on the sundae and recall some of the mythology of the Nazi presence in Greenland.
Right.
There have been, since the end of the war, and in fact, in the beginning of my book, one of my books begins with a review of the post-war narratives and novels of the neo-Nazi novelist Landis, who talked about secret UFO type research being conducted first in Greenland, not Antarctica.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And he wrote that series of novels where he said these novels are voller Wirklichkeiten, full of realities. And Greenland comes into the story because according to this post-war Nazi mythology, one of the last battalions was supposedly stationed by the Nazis in Greenland, where they maintained a UFO base, a top secret UFO base, or not UFO, U-boat base.
Yes. The famous German U-boats.
The famous German U-boats, which I think is interesting because Greenland would have been a place where, yes, you could have done that. We do know for a fact that the Nazis did place some of their little automated weather transmitting stations in Greenland to monitor weather and convey weather information back to Europe so that they could plan naval operations. So we do know that they did that. The other interesting thing about Greenland in terms of the Nazi mythology, and I think this is going to plug into your war meme or narrative that they're promoting with Greenland,
right,
is that in the Nazi mythology, the origin of the Atlantean origin of their, you know, Aryan civilization was Ultima Thule, T-H-U-L-E. Thule.
Oh, right.
And what's the name of the American Air Force base in Greenland? Thule, T-H-U-L-E.
It is Thule.
It is, yes. Thule. It is Thule. And by the
strange
way, it's not coincidental. Because that base is located more or less in the same regions that all these post-war, you know, last battalion mythologies say that the Nazis had their base. So again, just like Antarctica with Operation High Jump, we have a Nazi post-war mythology regarding Greenland, and we have a post-war American operation that signally highlights that mythology by either putting a base in that region in Greenland's case, or in the case of Antarctica, invading the continent everywhere except where the Nazi pre-war expedition landed. So in other words, you've got a pattern here again. And I, you know, when all this war talk about Greenland started, and the fact that Trump is concerned about Russia and China getting there.
Yes.
The excuse we're being told is, well, it's all about the rich resources and so on that we now know Greenland has. Okay, we now know that, but I'm not entirely convinced that that's all there is to this.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, just like in Antarctica's case, I think there are, let's call them esoteric reasons for right. the interest in that continent. America, let me just boil it all down to what I think is going on. America knows something. And it's either afraid that the other powers eyeing Greenland, Russia, and China might find it and discover what we know, or they already know and America's trying to prevent them from operationally utilizing it. One of the two.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't discount resources. I'm just saying there's another factor, I think, in play.
You think it could be related to the UFO file?
At this point, I don't think anything could not be related to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because I think at this point we're looking at, quite honestly, such a cross-pollination of all of these areas of interest that these countries have had for so long and very secretly and covertly. I think what they're doing is they're putting two and two together. They're putting together all this ancient lore stuff and UFO phenomena, and they're coming to the idea that this is all related. In other words, they're basically reprising something that I've been arguing for years, that you've been arguing for years, that many people in the alternative research field have been arguing for years, and they're coming to similar conclusions for whatever reason.
Absolutely fascinating, and it's also interesting to me that some of it is coming to the surface.
Yes.
Sometimes in very weird ways.
Yeah.
That recent story out of the Bank of England, one of the directors set up a plan in the background, a contingency plan for an alien invasion.
Yes.
you don't hear about that every day. They may have been doing it for a while, but you don't hear about it.
Well, look. If the Bank of England is doing it,
yeah.
Rest assured, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of China, the Narodna Bank in Russia, the Bank of International Settlements, the Banque de France, and everybody else is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Rest assured, you know, they're doing it. I just started rereading the old report from Iron Mountain book. And
yes.
You know,
tomorrow's headlines today, right?
Tomorrow's headlines today, you know, and they're palming this thing off as a hoax. Well, if it's a hoax, they went out of their way to make it one of the most elaborate hoaxes ever. But one of the interesting things that they point out in that, you know, 1960s hoax, and I'm not entirely convinced it was, but Yeah. Even if it was, one of the things they point out is the corporate headquarters that they refer to as Iron Mountain was a corporate headquarters and archives. So in other words, you know, what are they worried about? Well, one of the things they talk about in the whole report is what? An extraterrestrial threat.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the fact that the Bank of England has said this, all that's really telling me is, okay, report from Iron Mountain really wasn't a hoax. This is precisely what these people are doing.
Yes, absolutely. That is such an unusual book. Oh, and, of course, the easiest thing to do is to say, oh, it's a hoax, you know, and it was put together as an experiment or whatever. I mean, they often make hoaxes out of the most elaborate cases, like the Aztec UFO case.
Right.
The FBI went to great lengths for decades to get rid of that case and make it a hoax. Yep. You know, it's interesting. I'm going to read you her quote, Helen McCaw, who served as a senior analyst in financial security in UK's central bank. So she wrote to Andrew Bailey at the Bank of England. Here's what she had to say. The U.S. government appears to be partway through a multi-year process to declassify and disclose information on the existence of a technologically advanced non-human intelligence responsible or unidentified anomalous phenomena, UAP. The warning comes from a senior analyst with 10 years experience at the Bank of England. Quote, if the UAP proves to be non-human origin, we may have to acknowledge the existence of a power or intelligence greater than any government. Mm-hmm. And potentially, and then there's a thing that goes on about alien life. Now, hello, Brookings Institute, 1961, yes. Right?
Exactly.
But here it is in black and white,
in
an article in the Daily Mail.
Well, what this is telling me, Daniel, is, you know, it's confirming for me what basically I said back in that Secret Space Program conference in San Mateo, California, the first one. And that is that if you're the American national security apparatus or deep state or whatever you wish to call it, at the end of World War II, you are confronted with a threefold strategic problem. And that problem is the communist bloc, the post-war Nazis, and the UFO. And those three things are entirely, in a certain sense, unrelated to each other.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So what you have to do is you have to formulate a strategic policy and technological response to those three things that enables you to deal with them all with one response. So you create this enormous financial infrastructure. You begin to develop the exotic space technology, spy satellites being the first out of the gate. Keep an eye on the commies, keep an eye on those Nazis wherever they are, and we can keep an eye on the UFOs. So that's what they did. And the other thing that would have been very apparent to them is to do this, we are going to need a multi-generational trans-administration system of finance. In other words, we cannot allow the system to be subject to the vicissitudes of American domestic politics. We're going to have to set up a structure that can survive from one administration to the next over a very long period of time as a steady source of funding. So they set up this infrastructure, and basically what that means in turn is that the policy all along has been designed to deal, at least in part, with this UFO threat or existence or whatever you want to call it. That has been a part of American strategic planning, and incidentally, I would aver the central part of it since the end of the Second World War. So it's not surprising to me. All we in the alternative research community are getting now is confirmation of a very old hypothesis that, you know, me, others, you know, Morris Jessup, people that have been, you know, Donald Kehoe, that have been investigating the UFO phenomena for decades. And, you know, most of the people that I've mentioned that investigated it came to very similar conclusions.
Yes.
So, it's not new with me. if anything, I'm just the latest iteration of it, or one of the latest iterations of it. Paris Flamand, you know, another one that came to some.
Yes.
So,
yeah, incredible. It's not,
Yeah, he was way ahead of the pack. Long John Neble, you know, the old radio talk show host, another one, you know, the Art Bell of his day. So, yeah, this has been around for a while. What we're getting right now is confirmation. And I think really it's what they're doing is they're coming out with limited hangouts. Basically, they're finally admitting, yeah, the pressure's too much for us. And no one's believing us anymore. So we have to reassert our bona fides and our trustworthiness by admitting it now. The trouble is they waited too long. Nobody trusts them.
Yes. That's really true. You mentioned a couple of people in there. Of course, Morris Jessup is going to come up in a very interesting fashion a little later in this episode. And it's kind of a bombshell. What I want to make clear is a couple of people you mentioned there, Keogh, Jessup and others, they were in this kind of late night circuit on the radio in the 1950s.
Yes, they were.
And very deep research, very erudite intellectual conversations, in fact.
Yes.
And sometimes they would draw on celebrities. I heard one where Jackie Gleason dimes in. And you can just imagine this thing going on at 2 o'clock in the morning where you have Morris Jessup and Keogh and Neble and Gleason.
Yeah.
Really speculating hard about the UFO file. It seems to me the conversation around it got not only suppressed, but also, you know, they had this kind of fruity overlay that they put on it to drive people out of it. We've seen that before.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the Secret Space Program conference there. When we did it, there's a very solid foundation from a number of different professional angles that would have said, here's something that somebody, you know, in the public could latch onto without accepting, you know, very kind of speculative kind of information. That conference, and, you know, we could look back on it now, say 10 years ago that you and I did it. It's interesting because if you think of the progress that's happened on the secret space program side, it's very limited.
Yes.
Whereas the UFO thing, hey, the government's put out all kinds of things. You know, get this whistleblower, that whistleblower, Elizondo, CIA people, Age of Disclosure movies, Spielberg, forget it. But that SSP thing, no.
What they're trying to do now, Daniel, is they're trying to spin, in my opinion, they're trying to spin the narrative into, okay, there really are extraterrestrials, they really are intelligent, and they really are a threat. In other words, once again, they're trying to reassert control over the narrative. For a while, there wasn't any such thing. And they, you know, it was almost a kind of total lockdown. For some reason, they appear to be particularly sensitive to any suggestion that this stuff is human technology. And that makes me extremely suspicious that what they're going to try and do is fake an extraterrestrial presence and threat. Oh, and by the way, since we're faking the threat, you know, report from Iron Mountain again.
Right.
Since we're faking all of that, you know, well, we need lots of money in order to meet that fake threat. That's a money game.
Emergency Office of UFO Defense.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, to me, it's interesting watching the geopolitics of this. Because the other thing, it looks to me like what's going on just the geopolitics of the planet. It looks to me like they've decided, okay, at least the Trump administration, okay, the unipolar and bipolar world are over. We're moving back to a multipolar world. So what we got to do is, and I've been saying this for at least two decades, they've got to reshore into North America because that's their power base and let everybody kind of take care of their own region. So the world is being regionalized right now in major way. You know, we get North America, Russia gets, you know, the Northern Eurasian landmass, China gets the Chinese sphere, you know. So they're literally creating these regional powers.
Right.
I get the feeling that there is how to put it, the way they're doing it suggests to me, and I have not a shred of evidence for this, this is pure intuition, pure feel, but the way they're doing this regionalization suggests to me that they are also divvying up the planetary defense regions.
Oh, yeah.
Doing this. That's what they're doing.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a wow. If that's correct, you know, it's a big if. But again, we're you know, we go back to that presupposition that they had a strategic problem at the end of World War II, and at the center of it was this potential threat from outer space. So in a multipolar world, how do you deal with it? Well, we'll be responsible for this region over here. China, you get that region. Russia, you get this region. Europe, you don't count anymore, you know.
Yes.
You know, something like that. I think that's
they're being,
what's going on.
Yeah. And Europe's being demoted in that whole scenario. That's fascinating to me.
Big time.
Yeah, because there's they seem to be
country,
more and more powerful.
Well, yeah, but there's one country in Europe that's bound and determined not to be demoted. And they've
Germany.
Yep, and they've woken up a little late, but, you know, we've seen them wake up late before and catch up rather quickly. So, right. You know, be on your guard, folks. Third time's the charm.
Right, exactly. yeah, hello. They're on the march, 1934. Here we go.
Yeah.
The Rhineland.
Yep.
Joseph, I want to round this whole conversation out okay. on a scientific tip, the price of these guys working on these advanced exotic technology projects. You mentioned Jessup there. We'll start with him and we'll end with Nuno Lerero.
Lerero, oh boy.
Yeah, who was shot here just last month and under very strange circumstances, and we'll go into that. Jessup, in a most fascinating way, he comes in on his life as a professor of astronomy. Uh-huh. He comes in as an archaeologist, Machu Picchu, all these other aspects. Starts to develop an ancient aliens type thing long before von Daniken or anybody.
Oh, yeah.
And von Daniken just passed away recently.
Yeah.
That's an end of an era there. But I will say this. Jessup seems to be the person well oriented with his academic background, archaeological knowledge, almost like multiple lives that he has. And he puts out the UFO information, Case for the UFO. And the book is very solid. It gets into exactly why we should take this seriously. And in the late 50s, he's a dangerous figure to that establishment that's keeping this a huge secret. The most peculiar thing, which is the aspect that you've covered, which I think gets right into the heart of revealing anti-gravity research, is the whole aspect of the Vero edition.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's what gets him killed.
I do, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do, too. Yeah, for those who don't know the story, the Vero edition is a special edition of Jessup's book, The Case for the UFO, that was printed with marginal notes that were made in Jessup's book by Carlos
Allende,
who supposedly was one of the crewmen that participated in the Philadelphia experiment.
Right.
And that's a whole other can of worms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened was Jessup received a copy of his book with Allende's notes from Allende. Jessup read the marginal notes and decided this is wild stuff and it's sounding too good to be stupid. So he took it to the United States Navy, to the Office of Naval Investigation, and ONI actually commissioned a version of that book to be printed with the marginalia in the colors that they were written in the ink by Allende, by a publishing company called Garland Publishing, just outside of Dallas, Texas. That book, in turn, if you look at the people who were involved in getting that book printed, you will see them again in a picture of U.S. military officers, and I have this in my book, Secrets of the Unified Field. Mm-hmm. These military officers, including those two that sent the Varro edition to Garland Publishing, are sitting at a table, and on the opposite sides of the table is Dr. Wernher von Braun, sitting like he's holding court. Now, what that suggested to me in that book, and still does suggest to me, is that when the Navy printed up copies of that Varro edition and circulated it amongst top people in the United States, one of the people that got a copy was Wernher von Braun.
Right.
Just the fact that he's such a close friend with Dr. Kurt Davis.
Yes, absolutely.
Would have virtually guaranteed that, and probably guaranteed that Davis got a copy as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the Varro edition and Jessup's research, this is the important point. Jessup's research came to the attention. We know absolutely positively, because of the Varro edition, that his research came to the attention of the military-industrial complex. He also did business with it because he took that marked up copy to the Navy, which had that edition printed. So in other words, he is a key figure from the standpoint of the whole development of this technology.
Right.
He's simply, if I can put it bluntly, he's kind of a popularizer of mm-hmm. it. Because when you read his case for the UFO, he's throwing out a lot of very exotic concepts.
Yes.
But he's doing so in a very non-technical language, which he could easily have done.
Mm-hmm.
So he's popularizing all this. The last thing that we can have, you know, is to have him become a loose cannon with it.
Right.
I'm with you. I think the man was murdered deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't know, he was found dead in his car with the car motor running, with a hose from the tailpipe up to the cab of the car.
It's killed by carbon monoxide. Yeah.
Killed by carbon monoxide. Nothing about the man, particularly in that time period right before he was found dead, speaks of anything close to a suicidal inclination.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Nothing, nothing, nothing.
Amazing.
He was murdered, in my opinion.
Well, he's contacted his friend, James yes. Valentine, and right. he says, I have something very important to share with you.
Yes.
And he says, tell me about it. He says, I can't speak about it on the phone.
Yeah.
Manson Valentine would go on to discover the Bimini Road,
yep.
which is predicted by Casey in yep. 1932. And then you yep. have the Bimini Road. Casey says, expect it. You're going to start to see the Poseidon Temple, the Atlanteans off Bimini, 68, 69, somewhere. Yep. He finds it in 68.
Yep.
Same guy.
Same
Manson
guy.
Valentine. Yep. Yale oceanographer. Okay.
Yes.
Jessup is killed 10 years earlier. So part of the things that they were working on, again, you have that strange shadow of Atlantis in yep. the background.
Yeah.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah. I think possibly one of the things that Jessup wanted to talk to him about may have been that subject.
Yeah.
Because Jessup certainly had the interest in that. And he certainly, if you read his case for the UFO, there is this, as you say, there is this kind of ancient aliens feel to it. But it's not, and I want people to understand this, it is not a sensationalized element like in Eric von Däniken. He's simply tossing out speculative possibilities, you know, oh, we've got these texts, so it might be that, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
He's not a popularizer in the sense that he's trying to make a spectacle of it.
Oh, absolutely.
Not at all.
He's a major intellectual
right.
Force, I think, yeah. with incredible yeah. details. His conceptual information, I have one of his rare books, with UFOs in the Bible, which is really a blueprint
yeah.
going through certain segments of the Bible and applying it to the UFO file. But yeah. Jessup is interesting on a few levels because of the multiple lives that he led and the impact he was having. I don't think you could leave a guy out there like him, especially after the Varro edition. They're like,
no, you could.
Yeah.
They either
like anti-gravity is going to get spilled right there.
Well, my suspicion has always been when he called Dr. Valentine before his murder, my suspicion is that it had something to do with the Vero edition that we don't yet know, and it may have had something to do with Atlantis that he wanted to discuss with him. And my suspicion has always been that he was doing this because he had already been leaned on by the military. That he had to tell somebody what they were doing to him and so on and so forth, and why, and give his explanation of why they were doing it. And he was never able to complete the thought with his friend, but that's been my suspicion. So in other words, no, they couldn't leave him out there. It's the same thing that, you know, in a certain sense they did with Thomas Townsend Brown. But right. they were more successful in his case of roping him back into the system after he demonstrated a willingness to take all of his thoughts to France. You know?
Right.
Can't have that. You know?
Exactly. That fascinating account. His daughter gave me the account that he had developed this test for the RAND Corporation of the acoustic fan that Thomas Townsend Brown had done. And the person who was there during the demonstration of what this incredible acoustic fan could do was Curtis LeMay.
Oh, I can believe it.
And the next day he told his daughter, you're going to Europe, you're going to college. Don't even think about this. Don't mention the acoustic fan, anything like that ever again. So that development there reminds me of the Bell story in a way that this thing just goes black.
Well, it goes away. And again, the key word here is acoustic.
Yes. Absolutely. Joseph, the strange death of Jessup now, let's bookmark it with the strange death a month ago of Lorero.
Oh, boy.
So I'm going to say this, that there are a lot of weird parallels in that story that got me thinking about, one, the Boston bombing. Of course, here, over by Harvard, during that Boston bombing, you had the Zarnoff brothers driving around and tanks were rolling, chasing them. I mean, this is a very unusual scene. And we know during the Boston bombing, the Kennedy Library went on fire.
Yep, I remember that.
Very strange. Never included as part of the crime. It was just happenstance, apparently. and then the Carlyle Group buys the Kennedy Library. Very strange combination.
Gee. Gotta get that Bush family fingerprint all over this, don't we? Yeah.
I can't imagine that Jack would have been too happy about that. By a long shot.
Well,
but in any case, there's oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, he wouldn't have been happy about that, given the family's friendship with Senator McCarthy, given the suspicious things around his death.
Yes.
And then the Bush family fingerprints all over that. Now,
somehow,
you know how much of a high regard I have in my heart for the Bush family.
I know. Well, you know, they're right up at Kenny Bunkport. They hang out and they come down here.
Yeah, stay in Maine, guys.
Well, it's interesting to me because there's a strange corridor there. During the story, there were these things that were coming off. One of them was the fact that the crime of Professor Lorero being killed, he got shot and his apartment was literally only three blocks from the famous JFK birthplace.
Right.
Interestingly enough, in the community of Brookline, which is a really kind of buttoned up community. You don't see a lot of crime there, et cetera. For this guy to be able to just go in there, commit the crime and leave successfully.
Right.
Seemed a little bit strange to me. Of course, he was the brown shooter. And this is Valente. Now, just a couple of quick things about this. That corridor that he used was to drive up 93 and get into New Hampshire. He goes into that storage space and supposedly kills himself. Mm-hmm. And they don't find him till 3 days later, Joseph. That's interesting. Just try going into your storage space and blowing your brains out. Hey, 3 days later, they'll find you. Very unusual case in any case, regardless of how you track it back. But let's track it back in this fashion. He's down there at Brown, where he was a student in the 90s. He shoots two young students, and mm-hmm. it's a tragedy all around, but mm-hmm. they're shot. And then there's this kind of tracking thing that was kind of like tracking the Sarnoff brothers. He lands up here, he does the crime, and then there's all these surging kind of, you know, search and find mm-hmm. Parties that are out there looking for Valente. Now, like I said, he goes up that track of 93. And one of the interesting things about that track is the 9/11 hijackers themselves use that same corridor between Maine, New Hampshire, and Boston. Back and forth we go, and little strange kind of footprints in all that and indications. But Lorero himself, as you pointed out, was working right in the heart of plasma physics.
Oh, absolutely.
Right in the heart of this at MIT. There's also an MIT connection with the Sarnoff brothers where they shoot an MIT security officers, and that's what sets off all the alarm bells.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's what really gets the police on the run after them.
Interesting.
In any case, there are these connecting dots. What I want to know from you, when you look at this, I was doing a review of all the SDI scientists who were killed, 22 of them, in fact. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at some of the descriptions. I'm just going to read one here. Death Leap. Jonathan Walsh, who was deeply involved in the project of the original Star Wars under President Reagan. So he was assigned to British Telecom's secret Martlesham Health Research Facility and to GC, Marconi's parent firm. In November 1985, Walsh allegedly fell from his hotel room while working on a British telecom project off the Ivory Coast in Africa. He had expressed a fear for his life previously. No follow-up on the case, no leads, nothing. The next person, Death Leap again, you know, and so we have this. But what was interesting to me were the guys that were working around the underwater aspects of the case of developing SDI and Star Wars, that they all died from carbon monoxide poisoning like Jessup. So the patterns that we're seeing there and the tragedy around Nuno Lorero's case last month and this kind of high-profile scientist being gunned down like that, but with a great cover story of this guy who actually supposedly knew him in Portugal when they were at engineering school together. And then they come here. This guy, Valente, goes to Brown. Lorero is at one point visits Brown as like a visiting professor, but he moves on to a much more illustrious career. They have there the story set, the narrative set. He resented him. He became famous. This guy was disgruntled. He took him out. Doesn't explain why he shot the other two students.
Right.
What is going on in that case, in your opinion?
Oh, boy, that's a mouthful. Well, first of all, I remember the scientists that were working in the Star Wars project of President Reagan and all of the sudden deaths surrounding them, particularly people associated with Marconi. At the time that that was going on, it was thought that this was being done by the KGB as a means of slowing things down. I never thought that. Clearly, someone was offing those scientists, but it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be KGB.
Mm-hmm.
It could be somebody interested in preventing people working for the United States or the United Kingdom from catching up to their own level of sophistication. That's the way I viewed it at the time. So, in other words, it was not, we're going to prevent you from achieving something that we can't, but we're going to prevent you from achieving something we already have.
Oh, right.
So that brings us to Lorero. Dr. Lorero, from what I can tell, was involved in areas of plasma physics that were really kind of right, squatting right at the center of the whole plasma physics enterprise. In that he was researching how to control more efficiently the stochastic behavior of plasmas in a hot containment environment. In other words, he was researching the one area that you absolutely need to perfect if you're going to have a controlled hot fusion system of power production.
Right.
And his method, as far as I've been able to determine, was that he was relying on algorithms from quantum computing and artificial intelligence to predict the stochastic behavior. Now, all of that is techno jargon for what he's really attempting to do. He's attempting to figure out how do we create a controlled, stable fusion reaction, hot containment, without this random behavior that plasmas always exhibit under those conditions. In other words, he's right at the heart of the controlled fusion problem. And in being at that heart, aspects conceptually of his research trace all the way back to Dr. Hannes Alfvén in Sweden, the guy that starts off plasma physics. You know, I write about him in my book, The Cosmic War. Mm-hmm. Alfvén was noticing the same behavior in the mercury rectifiers.
Wow.
At the Swedish Electric. Yeah, there it is again, at the Swedish Electrical Company. And he becomes fascinated with plasmas as a result. He's able to solve the problem, but in doing so, he discovers a lot of stuff about plasma physics. He goes on to win the Nobel Prize. So this is not a fly-by-night guy. Well, Dr. Lutero is basically working in exactly the same type of area in plasma physics that sets the whole plasma physics off as a discipline. The other thing that you mentioned to me, let me back up. If you have that aspect of fusion under your thumb, mm-hmm. then you can manipulate a hot plasma, can't you?
Yes.
Like the one burning outside of my window up in the sky right now.
The sun.
Like the sun. Now, I mention that because Dr. Perat, Anthony Perat, and again, I mentioned him in my book, The Cosmic War. Dr. Perat was Dr. Alfvén's primary student. And Dr. Perat, if you study plasma physics, he kind of wrote the textbook for it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I cite both men, mm-hmm. and the citation I have from Dr. Perat's textbook is actually right up front in that textbook. Dr. Perat comes out and says, well, we've got plasma right next door that we could experiment with. And the plasma he's talking about is all that plasma dust between the Earth and the sun. Mm. That's exactly what he just said, oh, we're going to experiment with it.
Wow.
Now that implies an ability to manipulate things to a certain degree. So in other words, all this research that Dr. Lutero was doing is tied into all of this stuff, like it or not.
Fascinating.
So that means, to my mind, Dr. Lutero, who apparently had made some announcement to the plasma physics community that he had solved a significant problem, and then bang, he dies. He's murdered. That tells me there's an aspect of his research that is ultra classified, and either that he had not become privy to through his own classified clearance, or that he didn't realize was super classified and he's going to let the cat out of the bag. Either way, they prevent him from talking about it, which brings me to the other thing that you mentioned to me about Dr. Lutero that I find extremely fascinating. And I'm going to take another one of my wild runs off the end of the
yes,
and completely throw all scientific orthodoxy aside and take one of my usual leaps into pseudoscience and quasi-science and pure speculation, okay? You indicated to me that he was fascinated, Dr. Lutero was fascinated with neutron stars.
Yes.
And I, when I heard that, I was just like, oh, no. For those of you who don't know, a neutron star is a star that is so dense that it has collapsed. The entire weight of the star, okay, has collapsed down to the size of like a dice, you know, a little cube that you play craps with, okay? It's collapsed down the entire mass of the star into a space about the size of a die for dice. In other words, it's extremely heavy. You'll never be able to lift the dang thing. It will generate its own gravitational field, the size of a star, folks, and it'll be about yay big. Okay.
Incredible.
Yeah. To have a plasma physicist interested in something like that makes me think that perhaps he had figured out that under that super dense condition, you're not dealing with a homogeneous material that is not composed of interior regions, but rather that it might be behaving like a plasma, which has interior regions, definable regions within the plasma itself. In other words, that little dense neutron cube might itself be a kind of a plasma. And if wild, woolly, stupid, completely scientifically non-orthodox here, folks, okay? I want to emphasize that. But if he had come to any such conclusion,
yeah,
then that means dense materials science has got some relationship to plasma. And therefore, so does gravity. So if that's coming out of his fascination, if he's dabbling in areas that are so exotic and so off the books, he all of a sudden has announced that he's made some sort of discovery, you'd want to shut him up too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, a neutron star controllable by algorithms that you're associating with plasma? Ah. Yeah, that's a biggie. That's
The implications.
Yeah.
Off the charts.
Yeah, they're off the chart.
And yet the the trail of evidence is there for him, which is he's clearly working in that arena. If he had made the breakthrough, it makes him this incredible target.
Right. Any one of these things by themselves, I mean, they're all very exotic, weird concepts that we're talking about. That one that I just tossed out there being, by any definition, the weirdest of them all.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it's incredible. You know, yeah.
But any one of them would mark him out as someone that they're going to keep a very close eye on. Very, very close. And you can't tell me for a moment that there are no classified military industrial complex connections with MIT.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I was thinking in some strange way, he's an heir to John Trump's research and the particle smashing.
Well, now that you've gone there.
Yes. Yes.
Listen, I have a book that actually talked. I wish I had known that you're going to mention that. I would have found the book so I could read to you what John Trump was doing at MIT.
Oh yes. Well, there's the Van de Graaff research.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There's the microwave space research. Uh-huh. There's the particle smasher research. Which area are you talking about?
I'm talking about engineering the vacuum, the zero point energy.
Right.
And being able to do that and put it inside of a kind of an electrical cable.
Wow.
There you go.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an oh, my God moment. But wow. Yeah, we're gonna figure out how to engineer the vacuum, and we're gonna have these kind of vacuum electrical cables.
Yes. Yeah, this is the that's the book about the Cold War.
Yes, MIT Information Systems and
right. Yes. Absolutely, yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Go reread that passage.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's around page 170 something or other, if memory serves me correctly. But yeah, I read it and I thought, I literally was sitting over here in bed watching my evening television, you know, that I used to conk out, and I'm reading this thing, and I read that, and I just slammed the book.
I used the
scatological reference at that point.
We've got so much with Trump. One of the unusual things, which is not cited very often, is that he went into France with Eisenhower on a special mission.
Golly, I wonder what that might have been.
John was certainly, he's not low-hanging fruit, that's for sure.
Well, at that time, towards the end of the war, there was a French physicist by the name of Gavreau. Who had some interesting ideas about some exotic technology all of his own. No, Gavreau was involved in De Gaulle's Black Project's research into infrasound.
Mm.
And he came up with some very interesting equipment for the French military.
Oh, fascinating.
Yes, he did.
When you see, the application of that, by the way, over time, what happened to it?
With the French technology?
Yeah.
Sonic weapons.
Whoa. Yeah.
Uh-huh. We're hearing stuff about that right now.
Havana syndrome.
But oh, much worse in Gavreau's case. Much worse.
Wow, wow.
He was... He talked De Gaulle into building infrasound facilities all over France. And the kind of facilities that he was talking about for infrasound, it would be the equivalent of burying a very, very large organ pipe from a pipe organ underground and then using it to create infrasound. You know, extremely, extremely low frequency sonic vibration in the mantle of the earth. This guy was and by the way, setting it up so that you could use all of these things, not only individually, but in massive, gigantically scaled interferometers.
Incredible.
Yeah. Think Havana syndrome using Alsace-Lorraine. That's the target region.
Okay. Wow.
That's what
maybe now we know why they almost assassinated De Gaulle, you know.
Well, who was behind that? Organisation Armée Secrète. And yes. What are they? Well, there's a bunch of Vichy French and former Nazis involved with that little,
right. That little outfit,
including one Otto Skorzeny. Yeah. You know, wow. the connections never stop. So, yeah, would they want to get rid of De Gaulle? Yeah, probably.
It's amazing because there's this communique between De Gaulle and Kennedy where he says to him, who was it in the CIA who was cooperating with the people who were, you know, involved in the coup?
Yeah.
And Kennedy said, there's no way to ascertain that because there's a group there that we don't have any control over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that we're trying, you know.
It was shortly after that that De Gaulle took France out of NATO. You know, can't blame him.
Wow. And that's where you get the Permandex. You know, that's where they're exhibiting that control. And that only grows over time. Joseph, but the other thing, just to round out the Trump conversation, the fact that Vannevar Bush is setting him up to do these things like get Tesla's papers, to work with Van de Graaff, to be his man, and that he's in charge of the UFO file, the crisscross there with John Trump is just extraordinary.
It is off the charts, and there is you cannot convince me that the president does not have an inside track that few presidents, not even Eisenhower, have had.
Mm-hmm.
That yes, people talk in families.
Yes. People and that's part of the problem.
That's part
with
of
Trump.
Yeah.
I think for the establishment.
Yep.
And you know, he's coming in with his own establishment maybe, but
yes.
They are looking at him and they're saying he's leveling off where we are. This isn't good. He's got the same status.
Daniel, the problem that the establishment has with Donald Trump is, and trust me here, folks, I'm not a 100% Donald Trump is the next Messiah kind of guy. He's done some good things and he's done some really clunky things. But anyway,
yes.
The establishment hates Donald Trump for the exact same reason that they hated Jack Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And that reason is that Kennedy came into office, if you look at the people around him carefully, Kennedy had his own network.
Right.
Some aspects of it were plugged into the establishment, and many of the other aspects were not. They became part of that establishment later. But when it came right down to it, his closest counselors were his father and his brothers.
Yes.
Particularly Bobby.
Yeah.
Trump comes into office with a similar kind of close network that he has. I would argue even closer than the Kennedy family. And he comes in with his own close family, you know, with his sons and their associates. And he's created a network of power that makes him a maverick that they cannot control, just like that.
Yes.
And this is what drives them nuts. He's not poor enough that they can bribe him. He's got his own independent sources of wealth. So they can't do anything about that. They've tried lawfare. They've tried to exhaust his finances that way. That got them nowhere. In fact, it probably exhausted their coffers more than
his. Yeah, right, exactly. They were trying to throw him in prison.
They were trying to throw him in prison. Everything you can think of. We haven't seen this kind of behavior from the media since Nixon.
Absolutely.
So, they are genuinely afraid of the man. And I think part of it is because of what he might know. And that's just his uncle. Let's not forget Roy Cohn.
Yeah. Yeah. You
know, there's another big source of information.
Oh my God. Yeah. Cohn is so like such an architect plugged into the deep state.
He's not only an architect, he's a bit of a you-know-what hole, but, the fact of the matter is Roy Cohn knew basically everybody that there was to know in mafia and power politics in the 70s and 80s. So, what Donald Trump may have learned from that source, we will never know. President Nixon. Yeah, there's another one.
Close relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. So we will never know.
It is that level of information. And it's interesting because the Golden Dome, again, there's an executive order at the end of 2025, and you've got the UFO defense thing laced in there.
Yes.
You can see the amount of things that he's saying. Well, we're going to get out of the International Space Station, one. Two, we're going back to the moon by 2028. Everyone keeps promising that. I'm sure they're going to do it, but it's been an unusual delay, shall we say. But there are these aspects there that are preparing for a major change around space. And I think you can read it as the Golden Dome is a UFO defense grid. That's where I think Greenland, he talks about the dome in relation to Greenland as well, Joseph. Well,
of course he does. This goes back to my regional powers idea. That each power is going to be responsible for their sector of the globe and the space above it.
Wow.
What this is.
Incredible.
This is. And Trump, Trump's problem, or rather the establishment's problem, is rather akin to the problem that the establishment had in Europe prior to Columbus's voyage of discovery.
Right.
Now, we know it's over there. We've been getting gold from there and pretending like, it's just coming magically from somewhere. We know it's over there. We know. I mean, put yourself as one of the doges of Venice or Genoa. We know it's over there. And here we are stuck in the middle of the Mediterranean. What are we going to do? got to keep that quiet until we're ready.
Yeah.
For the announcement. So they get their fellow Genoese, Cristoforo Colombo, to make his little speech to Ferdinand and Isabella when he's good and ready, and they're good and ready to make the big announcement. It's not a voyage of discovery. It's a bit of theater. Remember Isabella, what she says to him?
Yes. She says, sir, oh, you know, the way you're describing it, sir.
It's almost as if you've been there before. Yeah. Thank you, Isabella. Wow. You just spilled the beans. Her Catholic Majesty of Spain let the cat out of the bag.
Wow. That is a great moment.
Yeah, it is. And you can just see her. She's the kind of person, you know, you're not going to put one over on her. So you can just kind of see her like, yeah, uh-huh. You know?
It's almost absolutely
like you've been there before. Who are you kidding?
Whenever you touch on Columbus, I swear, you open up all kinds of unusual things.
Oh, yeah.
I will tell you this, and in the Steiner literature, he talks about how there were groups in Europe going over to America and studying the doppelganger of America. Because they wanted to be aware of how it was going to impact the psyche, the health, and all these other things of the Europeans that would go there in leadership positions. Isn't that interesting?
That's wild.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, are you going to, you know, are we going to just fly a rocket to the moon without doing studies of the psychological and so on, you know, all the impact that we need to? No, of course not. So right. Are they going to launch this big voyage of discovery just willy-nilly? Okay, we got three ships for you. Good luck, you know. Off you go. No, of course not. No.
Wow. Absolutely fascinating. Of course, the Templar activity in America that you've pointed out. And that, I think, is absolutely fascinating. And I think we're going to touch on that again because there's so much more to bring out about your Templar research, thinking about the regional thing for a moment, because in the middle of that, you've got very strange stories lingering out about this part of the Atlantic and ancient ruins, and how the story almost surfaced completely in the year 2000 with, you know, Polina Zelitsky, the whole Cuban city off the western tip of Cuba. It was suppressed. She was driven out. Cubans kept it for themselves. But one of the guys involved in that whole Atlantis research was Egerton Sykes. And Sykes said that Venezuela, China, and the United States were the biggest players in that whole thing. But Cuba was basically like holding on and getting support from Russia, support from Venezuela. It's interesting how the kind of archaeological wars figure in with a regional move like that as well. It's consolidation.
Oh, yes. I absolutely think there is an archaeological there. I absolutely think there's a covert archaeological aspect to all of this, because again, going back to that presupposition about the secret space program and the end of World War II and the UFO, one of the things I explicitly said in that San Mateo conference was that if you are the national security state in America, looking at those three strategic problems, and in particular the UFO, one of the things that you are concerned about is the ancient texts that suggest interventions at various points in ancient human history. And what steps can you take to prevent that?
Right.
So in other words, part of my thinking all along has been that the UFO, by just showing up, is going to force those national security analysts to go back and look at those texts.
Mm.
And if they're looking at those texts, then the corollary is, well, we've got to look very carefully at those civilizations and therefore their archaeological sites and monuments. So, in other words, as a component of this deep state interest, you have an archaeological component that's going to be quite pronounced, in my opinion. Absolutely quite pronounced. So what do you see? Well, Cuba, Venezuela, China, You know, for that matter, just look at all the underwater ruins in the Pacific. You know, they're all over the place.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
All over. So you don't think China is going to be interested? Japan, India, Indonesia, mm-hmm. you know, anybody who's anybody in that part of the world right. is going to be interested in it. Russia, you know, let's not forget that in the Soviet era, the Russians were sending teams of archaeologists to Mohenjo-Daro in India, you know, that ancient yeah. site that is vitrified with, you know, people, skeletons of people literally holding hands in the street that have been burnt to a crisp.
Right.
You know, probably by a nuclear weapon of some sort.
Yes.
So, yeah, the Russians were doing this stuff, you know, and of course the Nazis too. So everybody's doing this covert archaeology. I'm not a bit surprised. Not a bit. They're going to do it.
Oppenheimer gave that little I am destroyer of worlds.
Yeah.
Vimana, you know, he was giving out the ancient texts. It's very interesting to me, the correlation there, because at a certain point, there's a technological understanding that, yeah, we had advanced technology back there, but you also have to take the next leap, which is there was a consciousness of understanding we're interacting with something else.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, that's the part of the story I think that probably has them the most concerned, because those ancient texts clearly indicate that there's an aspect of what they're dealing with that are just not hominids flying around in flying saucers, but something right. even, you know, more stupendous and metaphysical, to use that word.
Yes.
The other thing that indicates to me is all the current stories that we hear circulating, things like Nick Redfern's idea of the Collins elite, that might actually be a kind of true thing. I happen to think it is.
Uh-huh.
Because if you're dealing with a national security threat that involves metaphysics, well, what do? You go out and try to recruit the demons to your side. Mm-hmm. So what do we have? We have whole PSYOP departments of the U.S. military with people like Michael Aquino.
You know, oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, you know, writing books on psychological operations for the Army. Okay, you know, let's go recruit Satan to the cause of freedom. You
know? And they're like, hey, somebody, he's a Satanist, and he's our, you know,
and he's our advisor. Staff.
Like, come on.
Yeah, and
he's our staff. Give him a break.
Give him a break. Yeah, you know. So, yeah.
He shows up to work and a pitchfork, so what?
Well, yeah, you know, the very fact that they're doing this tells us that the deep state is much more capable of thinking out of the box than people give them credit for.
Yeah.
That's not a box I particularly want to recruit.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's there. So, you know, we have to deal with it. So, you know, I'm not one of those that thinks Redfern and his Collins elite idea is far-fetched at all. We've seen other countries involved with the attempt to militarize the occult. Nazi Germany being, you know,
yeah.
at the head of the pack.
Joseph, how soon, you know, we see them rolling out limited hangouts and false UFO threats, things of this nature on the CIA side. The UFO file's real, their version of it isn't. How long until there's a false Atlantis story?
Oh, I don't think very long at all. In fact, I think they've it looks to me that they've tried that a little bit before.
Yeah.
The problem with Atlantis is they haven't really figured out what narrative they want to go with.
Right.
And by narrative, I mean they have the problem of offering a locale.
Mm-hmm.
And when they really smarten up on how to do it, they'll realize that the Atlantis mythology is a multi-layered mythology.
Right.
That it operates on several levels simultaneously. And therefore, because of that, you don't have to boil down the locale of Atlantis to one location.
Right. Yes.
What's Atlantis? Atlantis is a continent, you know, in straight out of Plato. You know, go to the Critias, go to the Timaeus, read Plato's accounts. The first thing you notice, Atlantis is a continent that was warlike and it sank underwater.
Okay? Yes.
Now, when you look at what a continent can mean as a metaphor in that language, a continent can represent a planet. Water or the deep can represent space. Mm-hmm. Sinking underwater means, you know, being covered up by that ocean or abyss. So it could be an exploded planet.
Mm.
It could be Antarctica, because what is Antarctica? Well, it's a continent under a lot of water, ice. And
right.
There's every indication that it was once part of the temporal part of the Earth. And therefore, probably sported a lot of life other than penguins. And on we go. You've got all of these indicators that this is a multi-layered mythology. When the powers that be finally figure that out, then I suspect you're in for a real whopper doozy of a bit of Atlantis, quote-unquote, disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to be clever enough to tie all that together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's what they're going to do.
Well, I thought they
were. Remember who told you first, folks.
Right, exactly. You heard it here.
You heard it here.
What grabbed me about the underwater part on the false disclosure side was when guys like Mellon and Elizondo and those types were saying, oh, pay attention, USO, USO, you know, uh-huh. Unidentified submerged object.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly they were shifting from space to, you know, oh, this thing is going so fast underwater. And Fox News is doing, oh, USO underwater. Mm-hmm. And I started to think, huh, they're testing this. Maybe the UFO file and putting that out there is getting too many people to look up in space. We've got secret operations going on up there. They don't want people looking up there with telescopes and examining that. Forget it. Get them looking underwater. That is fascinating. It leads me to this, and this question, we're going to pull this question from the Nazi period right up through what's happening today with the Golden Dome. And I'll show you how I want to ask you this question. And we'll see what you think. So we've got a period back there where the Nazis are searching for Atlantis.
Okay.
And Hitler is obsessed with the search.
Right.
You were telling me before we even started tonight that most of those records, which are held in Washington, D.C., are still classified.
Yeah.
All of the Nazi examinations, ancestral past for the Aryans and all the rest of it. That's classified.
Yeah. The what you're talking about are the archives of the Annan Erbe Dienst. And the Annan Erbe was that special bureau of the SS that Heinrich Himmler, the leader of the SS, established before the war and this is interesting because this document, if I remember correctly, did not even make its way into the court record of the Nuremberg tribunals. This was kept so hushed
up. Oh, wow. Yeah.
But this decree said that this bureau was being established to investigate all areas of Aryan ancestry, you know, occult lore and so on and so forth. In other words, he made it very clear. I want you, the SS, to go out and investigate the occult, the esoteric. And here comes the key phrase, for its potential military application.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So in other words, whatever we may find out there, what we're really interested in is, can it be weaponized? So in other words, this decree is a tacit admission on the part of the leader of the SS that it's part of the thinking of the Nazi elite that there was an ancient high technology and we might be lucky enough either to find it or to find an indication of what it was and how it worked.
Right.
So in effect, what he does, you know, and I love Peter Lavenda's words for it here, and I'm stealing his words quite literally. He says what the Annan Erbe Dienst was it was a humanities program with guns.
Oh, all
right. So yeah, think of it as a covert archaeology program with guns.
Incredible.
Yeah, that's what it was. So yeah, I think with the Nazis, what you really have, when it gets right down to it, is you have the first modern nation state that's technologically sophisticated and has an enormous industrial and financial infrastructure to say that says, oh, wait, there was all that stuff way back when. Let's go get it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to fund it. So the archives of the Annan Erbe, you know, Himmler was sending expeditions into Tibet and in the Amazon jungle and, you know, all over the world. He's sending all of these archaeological expeditions. Iceland, Greenland, you know, Norway, and they're keeping an enormous archive of information. Well, that archive ends up in this country. So what is so sensitive in these archives that have to be classified to this day?
Amazing. 80 years later.
Yeah. 80 years later. Now, let me put that into context for you, Daniel. In, I think, 1994 or 5, shortly after President Clinton took office, one of the things he did was he declassified a lot of the Allied and American information about the Nazi atom bomb.
Right.
And in that tranche of documents that he declassified, there's the Zinsser affidavit, which is that German pilot describing the German atom bomb test in 1944, by the way, that I put right at the beginning of Reich of the Black Sun. Okay, so we have an atom bomb test and a Nazi affidavit that completely overturns the entire post-war Allied narrative about Nazi incompetence in nuclear weaponry. Completely overturns it. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. And yet, the Annan Erbe archives are still classified.
They don't want that out.
Yeah, they don't want it. Wow. It's either bureaucratic inertia, which, given this wonderful government, wouldn't surprise me, or there's something in there that they don't want people to see, or it could be a mixture of both, which is kind mm-hmm. of where I lean. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Well, you're giving them a generous out there. I appreciate, they should appreciate it.
Look, no, it's not a generous out. I mean, There is something, you know, there is something in there, and they're being good bureaucrats. Let's play it on the safe side. We can't let this stuff out.
Yes.
Otherwise, the whole country is going to be playing with Ouija boards. Right. Trying to contact power, you know.
It's incredible. You know, what's fascinating to me, what I'm trying to do with this question is pull in paperclip the Nazi Atlantis research and bring it all the way around to the advanced technology that we're witnessing in the behind the scenes mm-hmm. right now mm-hmm. here, and the things that they're talking about with the Golden Dome, what it can do, the weapons they're alluding to. Mm-hmm. And I'll do it through Hitler, actually.
Okay.
So Hitler, as you mentioned, he has these different branches set up to study our ancient history. He also is known as a deep, deep occult investigator himself, and part of occult Nazi groups.
Yeah.
Some of those groups might go deeper with the knowledge, and he's joining them trying to acquire that knowledge, or he's being used as the figure, the intermediary. And at a certain point in the 1930s, he employs a psychic, you know, and an astrologer to kind of guide him in these directions. And of course, one of the wonderful things about your Hess book is it goes very much into the detail about Hess's incredible occult mission for peace to dive into the UK. But in the heart of all this is the sense of bringing back that Arthurian understanding, the Arthurian consciousness, this Atlantean Avalon mix, and the Aryans as the super race in the middle of it all. So when we get out of the Nazi period, you get some of the paperclip scientists we've taken over here. One of them as you're aware, is Otto Muck. Mm-hmm. And Muck is somebody who we're taking over here for his Peenemünde rocket expertise. And yet in 1956, he writes the most comprehensive book all about Atlantis.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised.
And yeah, and it, the whole thing is about how the Caribbean was hit with a major comet. It sank Atlantis, and all these advanced groups went in different directions. Very comprehensive and very dynamic. Mm-hmm. And yet when I was reading it, I was thinking that name Muck clicks back to all this paperclip research that I've been looking at. And it's very rare that you see the Atlantean research on one end with the paperclip on the other, and those crisscrossing through a single individual. Joseph, what is it then, if we pulled over this advanced technology from the Nazis, when we got that through paperclip, what is the Atlantean ancient civilization, advanced weapons, advanced consciousness piece of the Nazi part into America as part of that paperclip program?
I've been thinking about that since we've discussed it a little bit off the record before we started the recording. And first of all, let me say, I don't think this Muck character and his Atlantis fascinations would have been unknown to the American authorities.
Right.
And moreover, they may have brought him over for precisely that reason.
Oh, right.
And merely covered up their interest in him because of his participation in the rocket stuff. Because, I mean, let's face it, we had the bumper crop of Nazi Germany's best rocket and hypersonic aircraft scientists that we could possibly lay our hands on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let's remember, shortly after we got our hands on them, we broke the sound barrier.
Yes.
So, incredible. Yeah, well, you know, as I pointed out in one of my Nazi books, there's a bit of evidence to suggest that the sound barrier was broken by a German prior to the end of World War II, and that, you know, that again is more technology that just made its way into this country. So there's no doubt in my mind that his Atlantis interest was upfront and probably a primary reason. Now, and I know that sounds harebrained, but I'll tell you why I think this may be the case. In all of the Atlantis ancient civilization lore of that time, of the interwar period, both in Germany, other places in Europe, certainly in Britain, certainly in this country, the standard model, the standard cosmological model that they were working with to try and rationalize the sudden disappearance of a civilization like that was the catastrophist model.
Right.
That this was all asteroids or comets or purely acts of God or nature that put an end to all of this.
Yes.
I do not, however, think that this was the thinking of the people involved in that research at the deepest level. They could hardly let it out.
Right.
That what may have caused it was a deliberate act of a technologically capable society able to do something like that.
Right.
Once you get to that point, that it's not accidental, once you get rid of the catastrophist model, and by the way, I would say things like electric universe theory and plasma universe theory and all of that stuff are similar attempts to say we don't have the technology to do this, so it's all accidental. No, it's the other way around.
Right.
That's why they're interested in it.
Right. That's fascinating because this character, this Hans Horbiger character, who was around influencing... Yes, and influenced the Nazis very heavily.
Yeah, and he's another catastrophist.
Yes, but he had this theory. He got so many things right.
Yeah,
he had a lot. Which is unusual. He's pretty advanced, whatever he was tapping into. But one of the things that grabbed me was that he said, you know, the moon is solid ice.
Pure ice, yeah.
Yeah. And he created this thinking that the ice must retreat before, you know, this is the Nazis tapping into this idea that ice will retreat before us as part of the Aryan Superman aspect. What was feeding his obsession with ice in relation to this?
I think Horbinger and all of those people, I think, are coming out of the milieu, if you want to call it that, around the Thule Gesellschaft, the Thule Society.
Right.
Because in their mythology, the Thule Society, and by Thule, I'm not restricting it simply to that society. I'm also thinking of people like Lanz von Liebenfels and all these other, you know, occultists back then in between the wars. And in some cases, prior to World War One, even. What's part of their thinking is not only this catastrophism, but this idea that the Aryan race ultimately kind of touched down on this planet at the North Pole, Ultima Thule, that's their name for it, the ultimate Thule, and then spread across the globe from the pole. So in other words, this cosmic ice theory is not just their cosmology, it's their history. It's their prehistory.
Oh.
So yeah, it's coming out of that milieu. So I'm not surprised that Horbinger, you know, you had in that let's just call it what it was, in that Central European swamp of secret societies, you know, interbreeding with each other like rabbits during that era.
Right.
There's going to be a lot of these ideas circulating back and forth, and they're going to spread. So by the time it gets to the Nazis, it's become kind of a, you know, Atlantis and Ultima Thule and cosmic ice theory and so on were to them what the UFO is to a lot of people today. It's the issue of alternative research discussion and, you know, conversation in the bars and the beer houses. That's what it is. Mm-hmm.
Wow, it's fascinating. And it's interesting because you have the setup with the, you know, 19th century Jules Verne, Vril, and Vril spills out into all of these different aspects of Nazi thought.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they're looking at someone like Rudolf Steiner.
Well, they're looking at Steiner, they're looking at Blavatsky, they're looking at Ledbetter, Waite, Mathers, all of these people that were part of the 19th century spiritualist occult, you know, mentality. And the interesting thing is, if you go back and look at what's happening in the 19th century with these people, we tend now to look at these people as being kind of fringe, quack, kooky people. In their era and time, they weren't viewed that way at all. Mm-hmm. They may have been, you know, they may have been on kind of a fringe, but they weren't viewed as being irrational or stupid or anything of the sort, because they interpenetrate so much with people who we now would regard as solid scientists. Thomas Edison, Nikola Tesla.
Right, right.
You know, people, Steinmetz, people like this. So there was not this rigid wall of separation between the esoteric interests and the purely scientific interests back then.
Oh, absolutely. Hardly,
you know, it was the other way around, if anything.
Yeah. Artists were drawn in.
Yeah, exactly. There was Kandinsky, a lot of, yes, exactly. There was a lot of, cross pollination going on with these people. And it's really one of the most frustrating things about that era, because we want to apply our, you know, our 20th century way of thinking to these things, and it really can't be done that way.
No question. Not to mention the fact that those groups, like Anthroposophy and Theosophy, predicted so many things.
Yes.
And laid the foundation for so many sciences.
There is a curious book that was published in the 19th century called Occult Theocracy. You might have seen it.
Yes.
The lady who published it, I forget what her name was, but there's a curious little passage in it where she talks about a technology in possession of the secret societies called the Frog, F-R-O-G, you know, like the animal, called the Frog, where, you know, you could use the Frog to talk from one occult lodge to another.
Mm.
And the way she describes it, she's either talking ahead of time about the telephone or the radio. Mm-hmm. And in either case, especially the radio, if she's writing in the 1880s and she's talking about Guillermo Marconi in the 1920s, something's afoot.
Interesting.
And it's afoot in these occult circles.
Joseph, just fascinating insights and information. Now stay right there and let's record another hour for Dark Journalist subscribers to go even deeper on how the Wonder Weapons, the UFO file, and the advanced technology in Atlantis lore fit in. Members will receive that episode in their inbox shortly. If you're not a member yet, go to darkjournalist.com or follow the link in the description of this video. All of Joseph's work is available at GizaDeathStar.com. Join us on Friday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern for the Dark Journalist X series. See you soon.